beach with a palm tree and an attractive looking woman standing underneath this palm tree. They're reading the big book, obviously. Really, really enjoying the road to happy destiny, it looked like. So it didn't look too bad to me. I mean, I had been living in the streets. I'd been a crack addict. I was 120 pounds. I had put on a couple of pounds. I had found my genitalia, because those of you on coke for a long time know that it didn't really work for a long time. So, I thought a co-ed facility might be nice. So on the morning for me to go to the Palm Beach Center for Personal Growth, this beat-up station wagon pulls up out in front with this big, heavy-set guy named Billy O'Toole driving, and he's got his dog, Sasha, this overweight, flea-bitten dog on the front seat. And here I come with my clock radio, and Bill puts me in. He's smoking like a chimney, so am I. And we start heading in the wrong direction. And when I say the wrong direction, I mean like away from the ocean. This is East Coast. He's going west by the railroad tracks, and I'm saying, hey, Bill, the beach is that-a-way. He goes, I know, but the Palm Beach Center for Personal Growth is that-a-way. And I knew right then I had been hoodwinked. And I get to this place, and I say to Bill, you know, it's kind of a rundown apartment complex. It's on the wrong side of town. It's the low-rent district. I mean, let's just face it. People don't want halfway houses in nice neighborhoods, you know? I mean, they don't. And so there I was. I pulled up there with my clock radio, and I begin to sniff around, and I don't see any women. And I say to Bill, where are the ladies? And Bill says, oh, this place hasn't been co-ed for a couple of years now. That experiment didn't work. And so for the next 3 months, it's going to be you and 22 swinging dicks at the Palm Beach Center for Personal Growth. And the Palm Beach Center for Personal Growth turned out to not be a real nice place. It was owned by South County Mental Health. It was a public place. And I turn around, and along comes this little wiry Irish bent over guy named Tom. And he's got a hand like a claw. And he takes that clawed hand and he puts it in my hand. And I tell him my name, and he says, my name's Tom. And you better turn your will and your life over to God, because your ass belongs to me. And I said, oh, fuck. And it did. And it did. And I tangled with Tom, the leader of this place, for the next 3 months. And I swear to God, at times, I did everything. The only reason I stayed sober was to get at Tom. Because Tom would tell me, you're never going to stay sober. You are never going to stay sober. He would pull my passes. I wouldn't be allowed to go out for the weekends. He would do everything. He told me I had to get a job. A job? You know, I didn't want a job. I was looking for a position. I thought there'd be some type of placement program. And my life, from my early sobriety, became very, very simple. It was me and Tom. And everything was put like this. Do it or I'm throwing you out. So I went and got a job. And I got a job at the Clock Restaurant, which is like, I don't know, like Denny's minus 100. And I got a job at the Clock because Tom told me to. And then I'd be sitting around group at night before we'd go to AA meetings, and Tom would say, you got to get a sponsor. And I'd say, well, I've been looking. And he said, well, you've been here 2 weeks. If you don't sponsor by Friday, you're out of the halfway house. So I said, I'll show Tom. And I had been going to meetings. I had been going to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. And something wonderful was happening to me, and I didn't even know it. During the 1 hour that I was in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, I did not want to drink, and I did not want to get high. And I didn't know what was happening at the time, but I began to realize that if I go to these meetings, I may not get loaded. And I had been going to Delray Central House, which is just like this crazy Alano club. It's still there to this day. If you ever get to Delray Beach, Florida, go to Central House. It's like the land of broken toys. I mean, there's... And I went to Central House, and I'm there at the 8:30 meeting, and there's a guy named Jim. All right? And this is, again, this is like in 1988. And here's Jim. I've been seeing him every night at the 8:30 meeting. Jim had a cell phone. That was one thing that I was very attracted to. You remember in 88, you know, the cell phones were like this big. Jim wore a lot of gold. He had these silk shirts. He drove a sports car. And I could see Tom hated him. Just couldn't stand this guy. So I went and asked Jim to be my sponsor. So the next day, Tom says to me, so did you get a sponsor? Because if not, you're out of here. And I said, sure I did. Jim L. is my sponsor. And Jim, God love him, was out of his frickin' mind. But I did everything he told me to do because I knew it drove Tom crazy to have Jim as my sponsor. And here I was, I got Jim as my sponsor. I'm living in the halfway house. I'm working at the clock. I'm going to 1-2 AA meetings every single day. And you know what? The days are starting to go by. And I'm starting to get a little bit of time under my belt, you know? And all of a sudden, you know, I'm kind of getting promoted at the halfway house. You know, I get better chores and better jobs. And I moved up. I went from the clock to Wags, right? And which is still below Denny's, but you know, I'm not Denny's yet. And I got this job over there, and something, you know, something really wonderful happened to me that happens to a lot of young men and young women in Alcoholics Anonymous. It's an amazing thing. It's called falling in love. And I am getting a ride home one day from Wags from this young woman that works with me. She's not in the program. And I asked her to give me a ride, and she's taking me to my halfway house, okay? And she pulls up in front, and guys are out there waving their wands at her and whistling and things like that. And she turns to me and she says, would you like to go out sometime? So just to let you know who had picked me. Anybody who tells you they want to date somebody on a halfway house, run away. But I did date this woman, and I moved out of the halfway house, and I got a second job, and I was going to meetings at Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm dating this woman, and I am just absolutely stark raving sober. Because all I'm really doing at this point in time is sucking off the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. There haven't been any steps, there haven't been any prayers, there haven't been anything other than going to meetings, drinking coffee, smoking cigarettes, going to work, going out with Tracy, you know? And then one night it all caved in. I had bought this car for like $700 with my clock money. And I had put like an $800 stereo in the $700 car. And we went bowling one night after a meeting. And I came out of the bowling alley and my radio had been stolen. And I went to look up Tracy and she had gone back to her husband. And and I was all alone. And I had been working at another restaurant at the time and a guy there had given me a card. And it was a card for a bottle club. And I don't know if they have those up here or not, but in South Florida, they have bottle clubs. After the taverns closes, there are private places where people can go do whatever. And he had given me a card. It was a membership card for this bottle club. And it was for Crystal's Bottle Club on 2nd Avenue in Boca Raton, Florida. And I drove to Crystal's because I had taken that card and I'd put it in my wallet because I knew that there might come a night that I needed that Crystal's Bottle Club card. And I went to Crystal's. And I opened up the door. As soon as I opened the door, I smelled the cigarettes and the booze and the weed and all of that stuff. And I closed the door and I went back to that car and I broke down and I cried. And I prayed. And I prayed my first real prayer in sobriety. Because I felt that, I felt like I understood at that point what Joho had told me about 6 months earlier. Where do you go when you got no place to go and you don't want to go where you've been? And I knew where I was going if I walked into Crystal's that night. And I drove back to the sober commune that I was living in, which is, you know, a lot of people know what I'm talking about. And I quit one of the jobs, and I started going to meetings in the afternoon, the day meetings. And at those day meetings, those noon meetings at Delray Central House, where all the old timers were. And I started getting to those meetings early, and I started staying at those meetings late. And I started to work with a sponsor. I got rid of Jim and I got a new sponsor. And I ultimately ended up with a sponsor by the name of Mike Ryan, and I say his last name because he's not with us any longer. But Mike became for me what I needed and what I model every relationship that I have with a sponsee today and what I look for in my relationship with my sponsor today. Mike taught me how to grow up because the fact of the matter was I had no idea how to live. I was 20 years old when I came in here. I had never had a bill in my name. I had never paid a bill. I had never done anything. And I was just running around sucking off the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, and Mike told me it is a spiritual axiom that the fellowship of AA will only keep you sober so long, that you have to get into this book and you have to do these steps. And Mike became a guide for me for the next 12 or 13 years. And Mike encouraged me to go to college. And there was no way that I could get into a college after getting booted out of junior college, but I went as a non-degree student. And I did that, and I kept going until they allowed me in as a full degree student. And I did college, and I did work a lot the way the program was. I just kept coming back, and I just kept showing up. And I worked my way through college, and I just kept going to those classes until one day they told me, listen, you're done. There's nothing else for you to do here anymore. We're going to give you a degree. And I said, fine. I have been working at the same job. I think since I've been sober, I don't know, maybe I've had 5 or 6 jobs in the past 18 years. You know, and the jobs that I left were when I went away, I ended up going to graduate school and I went away. But I've only been fired from one job since I've been sober. I have never been in a cell. I haven't had my ass kicked. And I used to get my ass kicked a lot. I'm not tough. And I got a big mouth. And people were more than happy to put their fists in it. And you know, and I began to develop a relationship with God. And God was one of those things that I wanted nothing to do with. When I got here and I heard God, you know, I had no place else to go, so I stayed. But I figured I could easily do this thing without God. Because I knew 2 things about God. One is, I didn't think he existed. And 2, if he did, I was fucked. Because he had been watching and he had seen all the I had robbed churches and stole purses from old ladies. I had done horrible, horrible things. And I knew that God, the God that I knew, the one that my grandmother told me about, that God didn't want anything to do with me. But through working the steps and going through these steps with a sponsor, I developed a relationship that I have today with God. And my relationship that I have with God today is still a very fledgling relationship. It's a relationship that it requires constant effort on my part to keep it. Since I've been in AA, I mentioned it already, my wife is here tonight. We'll be married 10 years coming up this summer. My partner and my business that I have is sober the same length of time that I am, and we have a great relationship. He's one of the most important people in my life. I have a sponsor. I have a new sponsor today since I ended up moving to Chicago. I've been in Chicago about 10 years, and he's been absolutely great for me as well. He knows where I am tonight. I have a home group. Morgan mentioned that in the beginning, and I did mention it. I'm going to kind of close with this. I think the most important thing that you can do in Alcoholics Anonymous is to get a home group. Some people say sponsorship. I have heard that said. But my belief is that I have had a home group since I was about 9 months sober up until this day. And the reason that I think that a home group is the most important thing is, and more important than sponsorship, is that if you have a home group and you go there every week, eventually they will find out you don't have a sponsor. And they will give you one. Sponsors are easy to lie to at times if they can't keep an eye on you. However, home groups where I have to show up and sit my butt in that seat every Monday and Tuesday or every Tuesday and Thursday or whatever it may be, I learned to become part of the lives of the people in those rooms. And I have had 3 home groups total in the 18 years that I've been sober. And each and every one of those home groups, those people from those groups are still some of the closest people to me these days. They know things about me that I have not told anybody else. And early on, they were men's groups. And those men in those meetings, they taught me how to be a man. And they taught me to grow up, and they taught me to be responsible. And for them, I'm very grateful, and I'm very happy to have been here tonight. I hope somebody got something out of this. Thanks. My name is Todd. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Todd.
We love you, Todd. Lots and lots and lots. Oh,
why don't they do that at every AA meeting? I want to thank Morgan, and I want to thank Cassidy and the rest of the committee for inviting us to come out here. It's just been a wonderful conference. It's a wonderful city. I love British Columbia, and we just had a... We've just had a great time up here this week, and, you know, I was looking out during the countdown, and, I mean, there's, I don't know, 800 or 900 people in this room, a bunch of drunks, junkies, pill heads, crackheads, crystal meth strung out, all... And everybody's excited to be sober on New Year's Eve. In my heart of hearts, I know that is not supposed to happen. I have been in some hotel rooms on New Year's Eve, and I wasn't excited about anything on those nights. And I'm very excited to be here, and I'm very grateful to be sober. As Morgan said, my home group is a California group, but I'm from Chicago. Don't ask me how that happened. But I am from Chicago, and my wife and I have been up here for about a week. And everybody's been great, but everybody that I bump into and they ask me where I'm from and I say Chicago, they go, oh, do you know Oprah? No, I don't know Oprah. But I have been reading a book. And I have been reading a book that's on Oprah's book club, and I'll bet some people here might have read it. It's called A Million Little Pieces. And the book is about a guy who spent 6 weeks at Hazleton, and he talks about everything that he went through while he was in treatment. But the thing that I was troubled with when reading this book was he was very, at least in my opinion, the author seemed to kind of reject Alcoholics Anonymous and sort of reject God. And I can't imagine being in this room this night and being sober and not wanting to have the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous in your life. My wife is in AA. The people that I work with are from Alcoholics Anonymous. All of my friends are from Alcoholics Anonymous. The best man at my wedding was from Alcoholics Anonymous. I am grateful to be a member of AA tonight. And any message that has to do... There may be other ways to do this thing. But this is the only way that I know how to do it, and that's what I'm going to talk about for the next few minutes up here. The fifth chapter tells me exactly how to do this. It says that our stories disclose in a general way what we used to be like as an active alcoholic, what happened to us, and what it's like now. Well, my story discloses in a general way how Florida white trash got all the way across the country to stand up here in front of you guys tonight. Is there any other white trash out or form recovery? I thought so.
Go trailer park.
Oh my God. All right. Like so many people I know in Alcoholics Anonymous, I grew up not feeling like I fit in. And there was really, looking back, no reason for me not to fit in. I grew up in a neighborhood where everybody lived in the same kind of house. Everybody's dad had the same kind of job. Everybody went to the same school. All the families were about the same size. You know, there was the beat up state. Everybody had the brown Ford Country Squire station wagon. We played soccer and we played football. We played baseball, and yet in this neighborhood that I grew up in, even though everybody was the same, I felt entirely different. And that would become my problem for my entire life and still persist to be a problem for me sometimes today, is that deep down inside, I don't feel like I'm a part of. I always felt as if there were two kinds of people in the world. There were those people that were better than me, and there were those people that were worse than me, which left me alone in the middle. And I spent a lot of time trying to be somebody else to impress the people that I thought were better than me. And I spent a lot of time being a real jag off to the people that I thought were worse than me. And I had an alcoholic ego as far back as I can remember. And before I get started, I'm going to talk a little bit about drugs tonight. And I know this is a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, but I'll say this just to qualify. I drank alcoholically. I used drugs alcoholically. I've done a lot of things alcoholically. So bearing all that in mind, I'm just going to let it fly. I took my first drink or drug, I think I was probably somewhere around 8 or 9 years old, and I think it was marijuana. Soon after that, I had my first drink of alcohol. It was a gin and tonic. That's the first drink that I remember. It was the first drink that got me drunk. And it sounds so refined, gin and tonic. But the deal was, you know, I grew up in this suburban community, you know, and we had lots of basements with bars in them and things like that. And me and a group of kids got together, and we wanted to drink, because parents were like drinking in another room. And we made a gin and tonic because it was one of those drinks that the name sort of lent you how to make it, you know, the name. And so we couldn't do Sex on the Beach or Long Island Iced Tea or anything like that because I didn't have a clue how to make something like that. And I had my first drink of alcohol, and I had several drinks of alcohol that night, and something amazing happened to me that evening. All of a sudden, that knot that was in my gut absolutely released and untied. And those two groups of people, the better thans and the worse thans, all came together on the same level as I was. And everybody was introducing themselves to me. It's a lot like Bill talks about in his story. You know, it was like, hey, what's going on, little man? How are you? You looking good tonight, you know? And I had this good feeling of being a part of something. And up until that point, I had never, ever had a feeling of being part of anything. I had played sports, and I had done all right. But even though I was on teams, I never felt a part of those teams. I had gone to school, and I had done okay, you know, but I had never felt a part of the classroom or the kids that I went to school with. But that night, I felt a part of. And I woke up in the morning, and I had a little bit of a headache. I didn't get sick. I didn't pay any real consequences for that first night of drinking. And something happened to me that night, which was the following. After experiencing that euphoric feeling that alcohol brought to me, being sober became absolutely unbearable. And I started off, you know, as a teenage kind of weekend warrior. You know, this was the late 70s, early 80s. It was sex, drugs, rock and roll. And I quickly converted into like the athlete and the good student to the black pants and the concert t-shirts and let the hair grow. And it was heavy metal in the 80s, man. And I absolutely loved it. And a lot of the aspirations that my family had for me, things like going to college and achieving in sports, none of that stuff really became that much important anymore. And as the years would go on, alcohol and getting quote unquote fucked up, you know, became the most important thing in my life. And I began to surround myself with groups of kids who were just like me. Where are you going, man? Going to get fucked up. What'd you do last night, man? I got fucked up, you know? And that's what it was. And you know what? It was great. For those early years, it was absolutely great. I had an identity. I was going to be a druggie. And when I was 12 years old, I had the nickname Burnout. And shortly thereafter, my parents packed up and we moved to South Florida. And when I got to South Florida, something happened. That little tight-knit little neighborhood that I grew up in, you know, where parents kind of knew kids and keep an eye on you, that was gone. You know, I moved to South Florida in 1980 and got introduced to just a whole new world. I mean, it was spring break land. I moved to Fort Lauderdale. And it was spring break, and it was Miami Vice, and cocaine was everywhere, and weed was everywhere. And I just moved to this suburban wasteland with my family, and I immediately latched on to the groups of kids that I wanted to spend time with. By this time, no more sports, gone. No more extracurricular activities, gone. Grades had gone from good grades to C's and D's, and I was just maintaining. I spent 4 years in a high school that I never, ever attended one football game, one pep rally, one anything. I spent most of my time getting in trouble, being suspended, and put into detention. And that was my life. And It was going all right for me a while, but by the time I got to be a junior in high school, consequences. People started entering my life who were not invited. People like youth officers, police, child psychologist, child psychiatrist, officers from the Drug Abuse Foundation. All of these people started entering my life and they were really, really hassling me. My parents tried to send me to military school and I ran away from home. And by the time that I was 17 years old, I had criminal cases pending in the juvenile justice system. I was in the Drug Abuse Foundation. I had already been to my first treatment center, and I had already been to meetings, 12-step meetings, not AA meetings. So I'm gonna talk about that a little bit. I got what we had down there called a Baker Act, and I got Baker Acted to have to go to the Drug Abuse Foundation and to go to meetings. And you know, this was like getting to be the late 80s now, and you know, 12-step programs were like all about the after-school specials and things like that. And I got to tell you, you know, something they say in Alcoholics Anonymous, nothing will ruin your drinking more than a head full of AA and a belly full of booze. Well, I'm going to disagree with that. Nothing ruined my drinking and my drugging more than my mother going to Al-Anon. It was terrible, this tough love, and you'd come home and there wouldn't be a plate set for you at the table. And you'd have the fights where if you're gonna live in this house, you're gonna be clean. And it was awful. And I've had to make a lot of amends for the things that I did during those years. But I started going to 12-step meetings. And the reason I did is because I had to go. And I was court ordered to go. And I started going to CA meetings, Cocaine Anonymous meetings. Yeah! They were great because I could smoke pot and drink beer in the parking lot and then go into the Cocaine Anonymous meeting. And it was kind of like old home week then, because you'd run into people, hey man, I haven't seen you in about 6 weeks. Yeah man, I've been here man, going to these CA meetings. Oh cool man, when you get out? Well, you know, I get out in a couple weeks. Well, that's cool dude, we'll have to hang out. So then I would go to CA meetings, and I didn't spend much time at CA meetings. And then I was sent to Narcotics Anonymous meetings. And there used to be a club down on Dixie Highway in Fort Lauderdale, and it was called the 971 Club, and it was an NA clubhouse. And I mean, it was the real clubhouse. It had the pool tables and the video games and all that stuff. And I used to go there, and I'd have to get my paper signed. I listened to some of the things they said in those meetings. And I got to tell you, when I went there, and look, believe me, when I was going to CA and I was going to NA, I had no inclination nor desire to stay clean and sober at all. So when I make it sound funny, I don't mean to disparage that program at all. I'm really just disparaging the asshole who showed up there. But I would be hanging out at this meeting, and I did hear a few things I liked. I picked up the white key tag at a Narcotics Anonymous meeting. And when I picked up that white key tag, they told me, "You're the most important person in the room tonight." And I agreed with them 100% when they told me that, because I did have that alcoholic ego. And they also told me something there which was interesting. They said, if you feel like getting high, you got to go tell somebody. And I had developed a nasty little crack habit by this time. So I was at the 971 Club one evening, and I really genuinely was trying to stay off the crack. It's bad stuff. And I was hanging out on a Friday night, and I was playing Dig Dug, a video game. And with this cat named Earl, and I said to Earl, "Hey Earl, man, I really, really feel like getting high tonight." And Earl looked at me and he said, "Well, do you have a car?" I think I broke something. He said, "Do you have a car?" And I said, "Yeah, man." He said, "Good, because I just got paid. Let's get the hell out of here." And that was the end of me, Earl, and Narcotics Anonymous. And we were off and on our way that night. What happened to me was, after I found myself living in South Florida and being homeless. And while I got sober very young, I mean, I was 20 years old when I came into this program, and I got sober very young, and you come around and you hear a lot of leads and you hear people talk about the things they did. Clara's lead was just beautiful last night. And sometimes I start thinking about, you know, these people that have managed to stay out there all of those years and have all of these great adventures and meet all these wonderful, exciting people. I never met anybody more exciting than Earl, but... but here's the thing. If you're a young person in AA, like, you know, like I was when I got here, and I guess I'm not anymore. But, I didn't have a house to lose. I didn't have a wife to lose. I didn't have property to lose or jobs to lose. I don't think McDonald's counts. I didn't flush careers down the drain. But the thing about being a young person coming into Alcoholics Anonymous is that alcohol is a rapacious creditor, and it will take its debt from you. And if you don't have a house to give and you don't have a wife to give, I believe it takes a little piece of your soul. And it takes some things away from young people in the street that are very, very difficult to get back. Anybody who has been in the street knows real street life, the years go by very, very slow. And I found myself at 19 years old living in the streets. And I was given an opportunity, you know, in South Florida, I was the kid walking around with the winter coat in the middle of August, scrounging around, panhandling, doing what I needed to do to stay high. I was given an opportunity to go to Minneapolis, Minnesota. And I ended up in Minneapolis, Minnesota in, I guess, February of 1987. And I showed up there because a running buddy of mine had been kidnapped by his brother and taken to Minneapolis. And he had called me up and said, listen, you need to come up here, man. They don't have any drugs up here. It's just, you know, it's just going to be smoking pot and drinking beer. And I got this great job at the Leanne Chin restaurant, and I can get you in there. So you can see what my options were at the time, that I was willing to leave South Florida and move to Minneapolis, Minnesota for a job at the Leanne Chin. And I had some warrants out for my arrest in Florida, and I owed some people some money, and they weren't nice people, and you couldn't discharge those debts in bankruptcy. So I decided to take the Minneapolis Express. And I showed up in Minneapolis, and I moved in with my buddy Scott, who had this beautiful apartment, right? If you've ever been to Minneapolis, I mean, it's right in the uptown, just a really great area. Beautiful apartment, got the job at the Leanne Chin, and everything was going great for about 3 days. Until Scott's brother came home, the one who was like the accountant, who was like 40 years old, and wanted to know who the 120-pound junkie was sleeping on his couch, who said he now lives there. I was given 24 hours to get out. I had no resources, so I did exactly what a good street little junkie does, and I went downtown to the Skid Row area of Hennepin Avenue called Block E. It's now where the Target Center is in Minneapolis. I hooked up with some guys at a bar named Mousie's, and they were young guys like me who were living in the streets. Some of them were riding rail cars, and they had all kinds of hustles and scams. They took me right over to the welfare office where I told them that I was illiterate, and I got on general assistance. I got myself a room at an SRO, the Francis Drake Hotel, which is a single resident occupancy place. And I started off again doing all of the things that a little street junkie does. I panhandled, I stole, I robbed, I stole cars, I participated in armed robberies. I did everything that you needed to do to stay high and to stay alive on the streets. I prostituted myself in more ways than that somebody really should have to. And I was 20 years old, and I looked like I was about 35 years old, and that was the life that I was a part of. Being homeless in South Florida is really not so bad compared to being homeless in Minneapolis. It's very cold there. And, you know, in Florida, you could always curl up in a bus station or something like that. It never really got colder than 60 degrees, but Minneapolis became a very difficult place to not have a roof over your head. And I ended up moving into a condemned apartment building. And I got to explain this place where we lived. It was a condemned apartment building where, like a four flat, built at the turn of the century, and it had a giant hole in the roof. So when it snowed, the snow would snow right down in the stairwell to the first floor. And I lived with a guy by the name of Rudy and his wife and his three kids, and they were all strung out on dope, and the three kids were malnourished, poorly taken care of, and they were one step ahead of the Department of Children and Family Services. There were bikers and pimps and hookers that all piled into this place, and me. And that's where my illness had taken me. And I remember one night sitting around this bar called Goofy's, and I was with Rudy, who was the guy I was living with, and Dennis, who was an ex-Hell's Angel from Northern California, and a couple of other guys. And it was one of those kind of mellow nights in the world of alcoholism. We had pretty much just spent our whole night at this bar shooting pool and drinking and maybe popping a few pills. And towards closing time at Goofy's, we were sitting around. Everybody keeps laughing at Goofy's. It really was a place. And it's not the point of the story. But we're sitting around this round table drinking, and everybody's like waxing about their plans in life. You know, and Rudy is telling me that, you know, he's going to go back to Chicago and open up this fish market, because he had been a butcher at one point in time, and he's going to open up this fish market. And Dennis the biker, you know, Dennis is this old, tough old biker, you know, he had this plan where he was going to do something with computers, and there was this other guy, and I'm looking at these guys, and I'm saying to myself, man, you ain't going to do none of that stuff. I mean, you are a junkie, drunk, we got no money, we have no jobs. And then it gets to me, and I tell him that I'm going to go back to college, or really go to college. I'd gotten thrown out of community college a couple of years earlier for stealing people's books and selling them. But nonetheless, I had told him that I was going to go to college and that I wanted to be a lawyer someday. And when I look back at that night, one of those surreal moments, the thing that hit me most strongly is that Rudy had just as good a chance of becoming a butcher as I did of going to college and becoming an attorney someday. We were all junkies, and we were all living in the Harmon Place apartment that had been condemned, and we were all working on all different kinds of schemes and cons to get by every day. Nobody had a job. And that was, those were the, Clara talked about it last night, the lower companions. You know, I'm reading it in the big book. I don't know that I actually chose. I really think that the lifestyle I had kind of dictated who I hung out with. You really didn't. I never felt comfortable being around, like, people that washed, you know, people that were clean. When you live in a condemned building, okay, there's no washer and dryer. I wear the same clothes for weeks at a time, never brushed my teeth. I was just a little scumbag. I would go into a department store to shoplift, and I was the one who the parents would grab the kids and pull them closer. And I ended up in a desperation call, calling my family one night from Minneapolis, and I told them that I needed to come home. Things had gone from worse to worser, and what happened was my parents wired me some money to get a plane ticket back to Chicago. Back to Florida. And I got that money, and I decided this was my grand plan. All right, the difference in price between an airline ticket and a bus ticket was about $120. And I would go out to the airport with some of my scumbag friends, and we would cash in that plane ticket, and then I would cop and get enough to get me to South Florida on the Greyhound with the balance of the money. Great plan, right? I did that 3 times, because every time when I got to the bus station, I didn't have any more money. Ultimately, what happened was they came and they picked me up and they took me back to South Florida. And I remember to this day the look. My father hadn't seen me in a year at that time, and I hadn't spoken to my father in 5 years. And I saw the look in his eyes when he saw me, when he saw his son. I was 117 pounds. I'm pretty much 210 now. So I was 117 pounds. My skin was as yellow as piss. My gums were bleeding all the time. I was having seizures on a regular basis. And this is what I had become. And I didn't go back to South Florida to get so clean and sober. I just needed a change of scenery. The problem was Minneapolis. And so I returned to South Florida, and I went on what would become my last run. And I ended up in a crack house for about 7 straight days with a guy who had just gotten an inheritance. I remember being in this apartment, you know, with the air conditioning down to 30 degrees and everybody's still sweating. And I guess the woman whose place it was had cats, and there was kitty litter all over the floor, and the crackheads out there know, the crawling on the floor, smoking the kitty litter, and... naked. And I walked out, and I walked to a payphone, and I picked up the phone, and it was about 2 o'clock in the morning, and I called at a card in my wallet, and it was a guy named Bernie A., Bernie Alicki, and Bernie was from the Drug Abuse Foundation, and of all the professionals that I had seen, Bernie was different from all the rest. Bernie scared the hell out of me, because Bernie was a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and he made no bones about it. He had been sober at that time since 1974. And he was the one that had told me about 10 or 11 months earlier, if I don't do something about my drinking and my drug, and I'm going to be dead or in the penitentiary within the next year. And both of those options loomed very large in my life. And I picked up the phone and I called Bernie. And again, this is 2 o'clock in the morning, and all I have is a business card with his office at the Drug Abuse Foundation. And he picked up the phone in the second ring. And the reason that he picked up the phone is he was expecting a call from overseas that night, and he had forwarded